Okay, so we have about 40 minutes before we need to wrap. And this is an opportunity for you to respond either with a question or with a comment, whatever has come up for you in the course of the day. We have a roving mic.
Thank you for coming. You know, when I was a child, there was a cafe that was very common in my family. You mustn't be familiar with your elders, and certainly not familiar with people who are below me. And I think the English equivalent to that is familiarity brings contempt. But I think familiarity brings something, complacency. So it's relevant to the way that you started about the wishes. I think sometimes, which is quite common to a lot of people, I think, is that seeing something in a way you've never seen it before. The example I give is that a person I lived with for 16 years, and had two children with. Although I'd been separated for a time, we sat just in an ordinary outside of a pub. Suddenly, I saw the color, I saw her eyes. That's the only way I can put it. I can't really explain it. I think a similar idea would be like when Wordsworth saw the daffodils. He wasn't seeing it for the first time. He must have seen many springs. But there is something by accident that happens, that we see something, you know, we've never seen it before. If I'd say that to a friend, I'd say, what's the big deal? You know, a woman who's spent so much time, the similar eyes. And I think Elliot could sing a different, a beautiful word for you.
Seeing it for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, the next thing anybody would say is that, you know, so what's the big deal? But I think something shifts. In my case, there was a woman I was separated from. I had many arguments. I think when that happened, something shifted. So you sort of just all on the way. We didn't seem to have many arguments after that. You know, something, I think the best way to explain it is that I stopped seeing her as my ex-wife. I saw her as a person. So I just wanted to share that because when you brought the Christians, I thought, well, you know, it's such a beautiful image. But I think there is this common thing that happens to quite a few people. You see something and then, God, I've never seen this like this before. So maybe you could add something to that.
Well, thank you for that. As you were speaking, what comes to mind is that one might argue that the whole Buddhist tradition began by a young man seeing sickness, aging, and death for the first time. I mean, this legend of the prince in the palace going outside the palace walls and seeing a corpse for the first time, this is not credible as history. But what I think it shows is that once the walls of familiarity, the palace, break down, or you go outside them, it enables you to see your life in a way that you've never seen it before. And that, in the case of the Buddha, or the person who was to become the Buddha, was the starting point of the whole path that he then pursued. And so again, I'm sure he had seen sick people, old people, and dead people a million times. But at a certain point, he saw them as though he had never seen them before. And I agree with you. I think it's this shift in perspective that is often what, in a way, wakes us up to a world that's been there all along, and we've seen it a million times, but have never really seen it in that way. And I think it also refers to the practice of mindfulness that, or meditation, where we think we're going to see something different. Whereas in fact, the point of the exercise is to experience our breath, our bodies, our feelings, as though for the first time. The meditation gives us another vantage point from which to reappraise the familiar. And that, I think, is at the heart of, certainly of early Buddhism, of Zen, and as we've seen, Lucretius, Eliot, it's a common theme, an archetypal human experience that transcends, you know, sectarian differences, religions, philosophies. I think it's something very central to the human experience. Okay, you're over here now.
Experience, observation, and kind of a puzzle about the difference between that I find in myself between a walking meditation and a sitting meditation. And I find the walking meditation or gardening meditation seems easy, it seems obvious, it seems natural. When I have something I need to do, like walk carefully, absorb me, and I find it not problematic. I find sitting off of the various, you know, as soon as you say go. In terms of developing, cultivating practice, do you have any observations on whether it would be better to do the thing which is easier or the thing which is more difficult, or mix it up?
Well, I would suspect mix it up is probably the way. But again, you see, you get as a recurrent motif throughout the suttas, the early discourses, the litany almost, sitting, standing, walking, lying. It's a little pericope, a stock passage that is plugged in everywhere. But I'm not aware of any passage where the Buddha reflects on the comparable merits of one or the other. He seems to take it for granted that the practice of mindfulness, particularly, occurs within any particular posture you find yourself in. And I think the point of it is in a sense to recognize that the aim of the exercise is not to become the world's best sitter or the world's best walker. It's about learning to integrate these qualities, these virtues, into all aspects of one's life. Now, I think there's a, I've always found walking meditation more, funnily enough, difficult than sitting meditation. And I don't feel very drawn to it. And so that, you know, being a lazy person, means I tend not to do that, whereas I do more of the sitting. But I'm aware that when I put a certain amount of effort into the walking practice, that at a certain point, takes longer than with the sitting, for me, something clicks, and I find myself just doing it, rather than being aware of myself trying to do it, which is often how I find myself with walking. In some ways, it's about that switch, that clip, that flip from it becoming a rather self-conscious, contrived exercise to becoming something we do quite natural, quite obvious, really, that's how one might sit or walk. That is, I think, an aspect of this practice that's constantly having to be negotiated. And certainly I do think it's important that we don't just lapse into doing what comes naturally to us, because then that's not really very challenging in a way. But we actually push our borders as to try to sort of uncover and to evolve in areas of our life that were hitherto, because of familiarity or whatever habit, we tend to overlook. There's a gentleman here and then behind.
I've really enjoyed what you have to say today, and I shall reread my notes two or three times at least. Have you written this up anywhere? Is a new book coming or something on the
way? Well, basically, what I shared with you this afternoon was a draft of a passage from what I'm currently writing. But then that's all of my talks, I'm afraid, are like that. I try this stuff out on unsuspecting participants.
Where will we be able to read it?
Well, I'm afraid there's a bit of a wait there. I've got a contract for a book called After Buddhism. It's going to be published by Yale University Press. It'll be a more scholarly book than I usually do. But it's not scheduled to be published until the autumn of 2015.
We shall watch out for it.
Watch out for it, yes. But if you really wanted the passages, then go to my website, email me, and I'll send you that little block of text.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Yes. Yes.
If I could just pick up on the first gentleman said, you were talking about care as being possibly the overriding virtue, and apomada sounds very sober.
Mm-hmm.
But now, suddenly, we're talking about spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Is there kind of line of spontaneity and humour coming through mm-hmm. things, for instance? Mm-hmm. Does the Buddha say anything about spontaneity? Are there any jokes in the...
Well, here's one thing that the Buddhist discourses and the Gospels have in common. There's no jokes. And there's not also any term I can think of in the classical Buddhist languages that would translate as spontaneity. In other words, there's no discourse that reflects on the phenomenon of spontaneity. There is one passage actually where the Buddha's having a discussion with a chariot maker, and the chariot maker has asked him, you know, when you give an answer to somebody, does that just come to you spontaneously? He doesn't say spontaneously. Does that just come to you straight away, or do you have to think about it? And he said, well, what about you? You make carriages. When somebody asks you about a carriage, do you have to think about it, or do you know immediately? And he said, I know immediately. I know the subject so well. I can straight away give an answer. And that seems to hint, at least, that to the extent to which one internalizes these kinds of values and so forth, to that extent, one's relationship to the world becomes, I would argue, more spontaneous. But spontaneity has a double-edged sword. It is a double-edged sword. We can be very spontaneously greedy, spontaneously angry, spontaneously stupid. So spontaneity per se, I don't think we can think of as a virtue any more than an intuition. You know, you can have good intuitions, bad intuitions. So I do think, nonetheless, and I think you see this more in the actual structure of the dialogues that you find in the early canon, where there's certainly something going on that's very alive, very alert, very spontaneous. That doesn't have to be, there's no great cogitation or deliberation, it's just a response. And we see this, I think, even more vividly in the Zen tradition, where you look at the koans of the Zen masters, and the whole point is to somehow snap the student into a sudden realization of something or other that comes quite spontaneously without any deliberation. And in that tradition, hesitation is considered to be something that gets in the way. Self-conscious, hesitating, reluctant, slightly fearful ways of dealing with questions and so on is seen to be, unenlightened in a way. So there's definitely a valuing of spontaneity and immediacy in Zen. I've seen it also when I lived in Korea. I used to often go and visit monks and lay people who were artists, painters primarily, and would spend time just observing them work. And, you know, the sort of calligraphy they do, orchids and Chinese ideograms and so on. And the artist will sit in front of a stack of paper with his brush or her brush and dip it in the ink and do the same thing again and again and again. It's a Thursday, so it's orchids, let's say. And all he does is he... And again, it looks spontaneous, but actually it has to be 13 strokes and it's all going to... It's highly formalized. And so he just keeps doing these same... Ah, that one works. That one goes on the other pile. And the majority, to the observer, looks much the same. I mean, if I could have done even a bad one, I would have been happy. But what that points to, again, is that this is an artistic tradition, you know, embedded in Buddhist values. And it certainly acknowledges that once you get egoism, attachment to reputation, fear, extreme self-consciousness, doubt. Once these hindrances go or are suspended, that frees you to respond in what we would call the spontaneous way. And I think also in the business of what I've been calling the four tasks, the problem with attachment and craving, it's not so much that it is the cause of suffering, which it is in many cases, but the real deeper problem is that it acts as a kind of impediment on the natural, spontaneous flow of life itself. Now that's my language, it's not the language of the suttas, but it seems to be very implicit that the purpose of this path is to enter what they call the stream, the flow. It's about living a life that's not impeded by self-judgment, not impeded by fear, impeded by hesitation, but rather it opens up the possibility of a real living response. And one passage that I had in my notes but I didn't read out is a verse 21 in the Dhammapada, which says that... Appamada, care is the path to the deathless. The uncaring or the careless, the pamadic, are already dead. So pamada, carelessness or care, uncaringness, the opposite of appamada, is considered to be already a state of death. And that's, of course, the very opposite to a spontaneous living response to ongoing active situations in life. And so I would read the implication of that text as well as being that this care is what allows us to live in a flowing, unhesitating, spontaneous kind of way. Yes, the behind.
Hi. I was just thinking about, you talk about friendship, and I was thinking about Sangha and that kind of thing. And I'm not sure what the question was, but it was something along the lines of how do you choose your friends?
How do you choose your friends? well, it's... you see, the term that friendship is... the Kalyana Mitra is the word. Kalyana Mitra means, usually sometimes translated as spiritual friend, but I find a little bit precious. Good friend is probably more literal. How do we find our good friends? Who is a good friend? And the Buddha doesn't really give him any kind of sort of, you know, five steps in finding a good friend. He doesn't say that. And it does, of course, beg the question that you ask. And again, if I look, or I'm sure many of us look back in our past and we think of our friends, how did we become friends? It's a very mysterious process. With certain people, we just know almost from the word go, there's a connection, there's a sympathy, there's an empathy, there's an affinity. That we find that when we start speaking to such people, the conversation just naturally flows and is lubricated. There's no kind of sense of awkwardness or anything. And I don't think you can somehow contrive friendship. I don't think. And I've also found that just, you know, because we're all Buddhists or meditators, therefore we should be friends. I don't think that follows at all. It may be the case that in your meditation group or your sangha or whatever, you find friends. But it could be that many people in your sangha are people you really don't get on with at all. And we don't like to acknowledge that, because we're all supposed to be spiritual friends, whatever that means. But I think there's a certain dishonesty there. And I don't think the purpose of sangha or community is that we like everybody. In a sense, it's more, I think, what gives sangha perhaps its strength is the fact that it is able to accommodate people who otherwise would really not probably ever get to meet each other. It's able to tolerate differences. It's able to allow us to value the presence of another person in the group, even though we don't feel a particular friendship with that person. But nonetheless, that's the person who might be a good example for us or might contribute very well to conversations. So I think we have to be careful when we talk of friendship in this Buddhist-y kind of way, not to think of it purely in terms of those of finding the kinds of friendships we value so much from our childhood and so on. And I think it's also a reality of human life that the older we get, the more difficult it is actually to find good friends. There's less and less that we're likely to have close affinity with as we get older, and that I think makes us value those old friendships even more. But I do think we need to differentiate between friendship in the sort of conventional sense that we know, and the sort of friendship, or maybe kinship might even be better, that defines the sort of relationships we have with people that we share common values with, we share common goals with, but we may not feel that same quality of deep affinity with. Yes, it's all very much within reaching distance. Yes.
Hello. First, I wanted to express my gratitude, because listening about the importance of care in Buddhist teachings made me very happy. Because to think about being caring and careful is sort of natural, very close to my heart. And I think I took it from my home. When, you know, I've learned it from my mother before even I met Buddhists. And I'm fairly familiar with Buddhist teachings in different traditions, and I've never heard it expressed in such a way. And I'm puzzled. If it's so important, why being exposed to Buddhist teachings for a good 30 years, why am I hearing it today for the first time? Why was it kept secret from us?
Well, it was hidden in full view, like a lot of these things. And, I mean, I've always been puzzled by why the Buddha's last statement, supposed last statement, ends with apamada, with care. And he doesn't say, you know, you'd expect him to sort of, you know, if you think mindfulness is the big deal in Buddhism, you expect the Buddha to end his career by saying, you guys be mindful. He doesn't. He uses this word apamada, and it is certainly true that in in many, probably most, certainly popular books on Buddhism, but I'd even suggest, even sort of more, scholarly works or more, close analyses of early canonical texts. You don't get diligence or heedfulness or care being flagged as significant, given the fact that in the text that it is given that importance. If you seek it out, you find that actually it's kind of central, as the passages I cited today. So you don't have to look very far, but for some reason, and again I don't really know why, it's never been a concept that's become a central concern for people who teach and write about Buddhism. I first came across the idea of apramada in Sanskrit in reading Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is an 8th century Indian Mahayana work that I translated years and years ago from Tibet. And there's a chapter called Apramada. Chapter 4 of the Bodhicharyavatara is about apramada. But even in that chapter, he doesn't actually use the word apramada. What's interesting is that for Shantideva, and I think you find this in other Mahayana works, apramada comes quite close to what we would call conscience. Again, I was going to mention that, but I didn't have time. There's a sense that apramada, this care, is a care for what one values. In other words, a care for what one thinks of as the good. And remember, that's how this whole presentation began. Pasenadi says, is there one thing that leads to both kinds of good? Now clearly this is a very, very central ethical idea. And the good, arguably, is what the practice in the way is about. Is to lead a good life. And apramada is considered somehow the key idea in such a sense of good. And that understanding of the good, I think, has as a moral dimension what we would call conscientiousness or simply conscience. It's often said, Buddhism doesn't have a concept of conscience. Well, I think it does, and I think that concept is apramada. Apramada conscience is the care, the careful, caring sense we have of what is right and what is wrong. It's a strong moral element. So again, and yet another aspect of it points to its centrality, I feel. And yet, here we are, it's not a terribly current concept. It's true.
So it's more of the big bow of gratitude.
Thank you. Okay, this side now. I've got a couple.
Hello. I wonder, on a slightly different note, if you would say something about the process of going for refuge. Mm-hmm. I find it personally problematic. The way in which you talk about the four tasks as opposed to the four noble truths, I find quite inspiring. And the way in which you've kind of set up your stall, as it were, outside the kind of area of religious experience, per se, seems to me interesting. So I'd just be very interested to hear a bit about that, if you could.
I suspect most of us have heard this expression, the taking of refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And there are two ways you can look at it. The popular way is to think of it as a kind of entry ritual to the Buddhist church. In other words, if you want to become a Buddhist, a paid card-carrying, flag-waving Buddhist, then what you have to do is go along and find a teacher or a center or community and ask if you can take refuge. And that then, as it were, admits you to the church. And you'll be given a name, Sanskrit, Pali, or Tibetan, or whatever, and you'll undergo a little ceremony, and henceforth you will be a Buddhist. Now, that's clearly the way in which the taking of refuge is acted out in most Buddhist institutions that I'm aware of. But I think that's actually, again, a somewhat superficial or sort of superstructure that's based on a much more interesting understanding of what that idea might really mean. Now, I remember my Tibetan teacher, Geshe Rabten, he said something once that really struck me. He said, you know, every time that you practice meditation, you are taking refuge in the Dharma. In other words, taking refuge is not just a kind of self-conscious act of commitment to a particular religion, but rather it's actually an expression of your own core values in life itself. And recently, when I was looking into the idea of stream entry, have you heard of that? Stream entry is it's considered to be the first sort of moment of genuine engagement with the path, or some would say the first moment of enlightenment. If you go to the earliest sources in the Samyutta Nikaya, you go to the Sotapanna Samyutta, the connected discourses on stream entry, I found this rather surprising, where the Buddha defines stream entry as the person who has gained lucid confidence in the Buddha, lucid confidence in the Dhamma, lucid confidence in the Sangha. Now, there, of course, you have the three refuges again. You have also the idea of confidence, trust, faith, but it describes the experience of a person who has embarked upon the Eightfold Path, which is the stream you enter. Now, if you think of it in this way, there's no sense whatsoever in that text that this is some sort of ritual or ceremony or formal commitment, but as simply as a description of what it means to embark upon, in this case, the Eightfold Path, or a way of life. So what it points to, at a deeper level, I feel, is to what we might call the core values around which one seeks to lead one's life. So to enter the Eightfold Path is not about just taking a few steps and doing mindfulness every other day or whatever, but actually it's about consciously valorizing a certain core values. Buddha means awakening, Dhamma means the practice, as it were, and Sangha means community. You, as it were, choose to lead a life that is focused around the enactment of those primary values. So in other words, it's about a reorientation of your core values, is what it really means. It's again, Appamada sort of embraces that, I would say. And I find it helpful to think of it in that way because it takes it outside the sphere of organized religion altogether. It has to do with a turning around in at the deepest part of yourself towards a life that's not determined by what I like, what I don't like, and kind of just running after things, but rather a consciously lived existence that seeks to realize this triad of core values. That's how I'd understand it.
Thank you.
It'll also be explained at length in the next book. There's a lady there.
I'm just revisiting meditation as a tool to make my life happier and more calm. So I apologize for the nature of my question. It's not as profound as many of the other questions in my head. But I was intrigued and I tried to understand the concept that you said, like meditating improves reactiveness. Mm-hmm. And I'm familiar with the concept, action-reaction, but I can't see how meditation into the middle. So if you could elaborate a little bit more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, again, the more that I've thought about this and tried to sort of unpack what seems to be the earliest Buddhist understanding of these things, meditation is very often thought of as a kind of an inner, you know, state of being in which you feel, you know, at home, calm, present, and so on. And, you know, I hear people say things like, you know, I do my meditation when I'm jogging, or whatever. People will use the word meditation to denote that frame of mind they find themselves in which they feel most at ease, most clear, most somehow in the flow of life. And that's entirely, you know, I have no problem with that at all. I think that's a wonderful thing. And I very much hope you find a huge amount of happiness through doing this. But I would also argue that it's a somewhat limited understanding of where meditation fits into the overall philosophy of life. And that to me is an important question. You know, why do I meditate? It might be that for many people I meditate because I want to feel more peaceful. I want to feel more calm. I'd like to be more happy. And if it achieves those goals, then obviously that's quite adequate for you. But I think for many of us, and I would certainly include myself, I've never really been particularly interested in meditation as such. Meditation has always been for me an integral part of a philosophy of life, or Buddhism, if you wish, or the Dharma. And so I always seek to try to understand how it works within the framework of that tradition, but more importantly within that framework of philosophy and ethics. The Buddha, when he often uses these three principles of ethics, meditation, wisdom, or philosophy. And he says it's like, well, I don't know if he says it, my Zen master used to say, these are like the three legs of a tripod. And if one of the legs is missing, the whole thing will fall over. So it's quite explicit. If you're practicing meditation within this framework, that meditation, ethics, and wisdom are somehow necessary to create a kind of integration or a life that's somehow integrated with all of the values in your life. The meditation is not just a kind of optional extra that you may or may not find useful, but it's an integral part of how to lead a fulfilled life. And just to give you an example, for me, meditation, mindfulness, let's just say meditation, has been very central to my work as a writer. It's been very central to my work as an artist, that the ability, as it were, to find that kind of stillness and clarity and restfulness in which I feel fairly, you know, open to life without any preconceived ideas of what I should or shouldn't be doing. That frame of mind, I feel, opens us to the sources of our own creativity and imagination. And these are words, again, you don't hear a lot about in Buddhism. But experientially, I found that to be more, again and again, to be the case. That meditation allows me to suspend my habitual, chattering, egocentric mind to some degree, but not as an end, but I don't think of that as an end in itself. I think of meditation as one of several tools that enables us to find within ourselves the possibility of thinking, speaking, acting, creating, doing whatever we do, from a place that's not determined by our neurotic hang-ups, our sense of pride or egoism, our attachments, our fears, and so on. And that, I think, whether you call yourself a Buddhist or not, would be constitutive of what we would probably think of as leading as a richer, more full life. And so to that extent, that's why I feel meditation is very much bringing us into a frame of mind that primes us in a way to respond in a more creative, imaginative way, hopefully a wiser and kinder way, to the situations of life. And I can't really think of meditation for myself as separate from that wider project of learning to be more fully human. And that brings us to a close. Thank you very much.